We'll begin in Hebrews chapter 10, verse 32.
But recall the former days in which, after you were illuminated, you endured a great struggle with sufferings, partly while you were made a spectacle, both by reproaches and tribulations, and partly while you became companions of those who were so treated. For you had compassion on me in my chains, and joyfully accepted the plundering of your goods, knowing that you have a better and an enduring possession for yourselves in heaven. Therefore, do not cast away your confidence, which has great reward. For you have need of endurance, so that after you have done the will of God, you may receive the promise.
Moving ahead to Hebrews chapter 11. By faith, Moses forsook Egypt, not fearing the wrath of the king, for he endured as seeing him who is invisible. Skipping again to Hebrews 11:35b. Others were tortured, not accepting deliverance, that they might obtain a better resurrection. Still others had trial of mockings and scourgings, yes, and of chains and imprisonment. They were stoned, they were sawn in two, were tempted, were slain with the sword. They wandered about in sheepskins and goatskins, being destitute, afflicted, tormented, of whom the world was not worthy. They wandered in deserts and mountains and dens and caves of the earth.
Starting in Hebrews 12, verse 1. Therefore, we also, since we are surrounded by so great a cloud of witnesses, let us lay aside every weight and the sin which so easily ensnares us, and let us run with endurance the race that is set before us, looking unto Jesus, the author and finisher of our faith, who for the joy that was set before him endured the cross, despising the shame, and has sat down at the right hand of the throne of God. For consider him who endured such hostility from sinners against himself, lest you become weary and discouraged in your souls. You have not yet resisted to bloodshed, striving against sin. And you have forgotten the exhortation which speaks to you as sons. My son, do not despise the chastening of the Lord, nor be discouraged when you are rebuked by him. For whom the Lord loves, he chastens, and scourges every son whom he receives.
If you endure chastening, God deals with you as with sons. For what son is there whom a father does not chasten? But if you are without chastening, of which all have become partakers, then you are illegitimate and not sons. Furthermore, we have had human fathers who corrected us, and we paid them respect. Shall we not much more readily be in subjection to the Father of spirits and live? For they indeed for a few days chastened us as seemed best to them, but he for our profit, that we may be partakers of his holiness. Now no chastening seems to be joyful for the present, but painful. Nevertheless, afterward it yields the peaceable fruit of righteousness to those who have been trained by it. Therefore strengthen the hands which hang down and the feeble knees, and make straight paths for your feet, so that what is lame may not be dislocated, but rather be healed. May God bless the preaching of his word.
Thank you, brothers. Well, I'm thankful there's more than 50 of you here this morning. We weren't sure how many of you would come. And as Pastor Patrick said, that's why we kind of pause on the Habakkuk series. The next passage is so central to the book of Habakkuk that we wanted our full congregation to be here to hear that. And so here we are in Hebrews. And as you followed along, I hope, what stood out to you is the word endure over and over and over again. This is the call that we, as God's people, would endure persevere, keep running in the midst of all of the pressures that we face. And he uses this illustration of running, I think intentionally. For those of you, I guess this applies to those of you who run and those of you who hate running. But I have ran in my life. It is one of the worst. I just don't do it. Let's just say that. I don't prefer to run unless I'm given a reason to run. If I'm playing a game, I'll run. High school, I played lots of sports. There's been a couple occasions in my life where I've ran, not to where I've passed out, but to where I've blacked out. And so I think I'm qualified to talk about how horrible running is. So all you lovers of running, I'm sorry. But when you lack endurance and you're running, what begins to happen? Well, your body begins to slow down. Your form begins to break down. You run sloppy. Your lungs, they're screaming at you. Your legs are on fire. Your stomach begins to feel nauseous. And when that's going on, what's running through our minds when that happens? I think, why am I doing this? What is the point of doing this? I could stop right now, and I wouldn't have to go through this any longer. I'm not sure if I can finish this. I'm not sure if I want to finish this. I just want to quit. And these same questions are the same questions that pop into our minds when we begin to grow weary from the trials of life. We begin to grow weary, faint-hearted as we seek to cling to Christ, to cling to God, to keep praying, keep depending on him. And we're asking the question, can I keep doing this? Is it worth it? Because for the Hebrew, the people written to in the book of Hebrews, once they converted to Jesus, their life got harder. And because of that, they're looking back and saying, is it better for me to just go back to the way things used to be? I'm not sure I can keep going. Now, of course, we know that spiritual endurance is different than physical endurance. It's easy to say, well, if I want to build physical endurance, I just run. I just build muscle. I just adapt. The direction, the steps are easier. But then when we ask, well, how do we build spiritual endurance? That's a different question. It's a little harder to answer. And to help us think through this, I want to just share a story of Viktor Frankl. He's a Holocaust survivor. He was placed in 4 concentration camps over the span of 4 years, one of those being Auschwitz. He lost his wife, he lost his parents, he lost his brothers. And you know, I'm not going to go into detail. We all know the miseries and the horrors that people faced in these camps. And he faced them himself, and he faced them alongside countless others. And now here's why I'm bringing this up. He survived, he reflected on his experience, he wrote some books, and one of the things that he shares is how people that he was alongside with in these camps, how they shared the same set of circumstances and yet responded so differently to those same sufferings, to those same miseries. Some people, they grew numb, they grew heartless, they began to just give up. And he said every time when he noticed that someone gave up and just resigned themselves to what was going on, he said within just a few days, they were gone. They wouldn't make it. But then there were others, again, same miseries, same atrocities, same struggles, same agonies. These people responded completely different. They would show hospitality. They would help the weak. They would give away what little food they had, or they would come alongside people who were sick to help them. They shared their meals. They retained a sense of humor. Same circumstances, same response. And these are the people, he said, that made it. And the question is why? What made the difference? And he's reasoning this out, having a front row seat to all of this. And what he concludes is that it was their attitude towards their own suffering that made the difference. Those that endured had a kind of perspective that gave them meaning, it gave them purpose as they went through their struggle, and because of that, it transformed their experience of their suffering. It was more bearable. The pain was lighter due to their perspective, even though the pain wasn't reduced. I think that's very important. They didn't suffer less. The pain didn't go away. But their perspective made their pain bearable. So we don't want to belittle suffering. And I hope that's not what I do today. He says this: everything can be taken from a man but one thing, the last of the human freedoms, to choose one's attitude in any given set of circumstances. And that's what makes the difference. And in Hebrews 12, what it's concerned about is reframing, reshaping our perspective, because that's what will help us build endurance to keep running. And I don't know about you, but there's some people, I see them, and I watch them go through certain things, and I think, I have no idea how that person's still going. If that were me, I feel like I couldn't say that I wouldn't. I don't know. I feel like maybe I would have given up, but they keep going. How do they do that? What is supplying them the energy to bear up underneath the pain, put their head down, and go forward? Well, I would say it's, and if you talked with them, it's just their perspective. And the author of Hebrews in chapter 12 wants to give us, help us with our perspective, and he gives us four considerations that help us reframe our perspective so that we can run with endurance. So if you're taking notes, it's the first thing we need to consider. First point, we need to consider what Jesus endured. Look at chapter 12, verse 1 again. Therefore, we also, since we are surrounded by so great a cloud of witnesses, talking about all the saints who have gone before us, who have gone to be with the Lord, who have finished the race, who did not give in, all of those people, all of those witnesses in heaven, let us lay aside every weight and sin which so easily ensnares us. If I had a 90-minute sermon, I'd preach that, but I don't. I was told I have to beat the snow. That's great. We're just going to move past that. Great truth. Here's where we focus in. And let us run with endurance the race that is set before us. How do we run with endurance? Looking unto Jesus, the author and finisher of our faith, who for the joy that was set before him endured the cross, despising the shame, and has sat down at the right hand of the throne of God. Verse 3, for consider him who endured such hostility from sinners against himself, lest you become weary and discouraged in your souls. Here's what this is saying. When we look at what Jesus went through, and we look at his suffering, it protects our souls. It protects us from being weary, faint-hearted, or if we are weary and faint-hearted in the moment, when we look to Jesus, it's almost like a rope that's cast to help pull us out of that despair. Why is that? Well, this is what helps me to think through this. Some of you, if you've known me long enough, you've heard this before. There's this movie. Is Mike Smith in here? Somewhere. Me and him, we watch war movies together. It's a great time. One of the movies he introduced to me was We Were Soldiers, and it's about the Vietnam War. And there was this general, it's based on a true story, General Harold Moore, and he's training his people, and he promises his platoon, he tells them, I will be the first man in any major battle. I will be the first man on the ground and the last man to leave every battle. This is what he tells his men. And this was very uncharacteristic for a general, because typically the general wants to be protected because he has the war plan. He's got to make decisions in the heat of the moment. He has to lead, and so he's never on the front lines. And so for those reasons, this made what General Moore said unprecedented. And when they were going to their first battle, they were coming in on helicopters. They're supposed to land. It was supposed to be a smooth landing. But as they're entering the landing zone, they come under heavy fire. And now I want you just to imagine the fear of such a circumstance. You're coming in, and as a soldier, you're preparing to jump, hands trembling, stomach churning. What if, what if, what if? The first helicopter begins to lower, and guess who's on that helicopter? Well, it's General Moore. And you're a soldier, you're watching this, and you see your general, that helicopter's lowered, he's the first one who jumps out into this open field. And for a moment, he is the only one, he's the single target for every single enemy rifle. What he was showing his men was that he was not going to ask them to do anything that he wasn't willing to do himself. Was he going to ask them, his soldiers, to put themselves in dangers, to risk their lives, to run first into danger, to do crazy things like jump from a helicopter into an open field? Yes, he was. But not without first doing it himself. Now, what kind of message do you think that sends to all these other soldiers following behind him? What kind of psychological impact does that have on someone? There's a massive difference between a general radioing his men from safety, yelling, do this, do this, risk, 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 and the general who, after having jumped himself, looks back and says, risk with me. Massive difference. And what that did is it strengthened the resolve of all the soldiers behind him. They gained courage watching their generals. Their fears evaporated. In its place, courage emerges. And so they jumped. And this is part of what I think the impact that this text ought to have on us. When we read that Jesus endured these things, he endured the cross, he endured hostility, we don't have a Savior shouting down commands to us from the safety of heaven, completely unscathed, unharmed, never having tasted pain, calling us to deny ourselves, calling us to lay down our lives, calling us to die if necessary. That's not the kind of captain that we have. Jesus stands today in heaven with the scars on his body for what he endured. He also has endured hostility from this world. I mean, if we learned this from the book of Mark. Consider what Jesus went through. He was rejected by his hometown, rejected by his family, falsely accused as an evil man, as a corrupt man. He was labeled as satanic. He was labeled as insane. His own family, they said, you're out of your mind for doing this. He was wrongfully arrested. He was beaten, physically abused, mocked, spit on. His own people shouted for his crucifixion. He was stripped of his clothing, humiliated, nailed on the cross in front of his own family. He was abandoned by his closest friends. His closest friend, Peter, right? Oh, I'll never leave your side. Flees, and then when called out as a disciple, he says, I have nothing to do with that man. I don't know him at all. He was mocked even by the lowest of the low. And what the author of Hebrews is trying to help us understand is this. Whatever you might have to endure, whatever you might suffer for Christ, he's already been there. And Jesus does not call you to do anything that he hasn't first done himself. And worse, we know this, but even worse, when it says he endured the cross, there's more than just physical suffering that he's facing. We know that he took the wrath of God in our place. We know that this is why he was agonizing in the Garden of Gethsemane, right? Right, we could talk about the horrors of crucifixion. Pastor Curtis did that in our series on Mark. I'm not going to go into detail on that. But when Jesus is agonizing in the Garden of Gethsemane, sweating drops of blood, it's not because he's afraid of what a couple Roman soldiers can do with some nails and two pieces of wood. That's not what scares him. The man who said, do not fear those who kill the body, but fear him who can destroy both body and soul in hell, is not walking to the crucifixion fearing what man's going to do to him. What is agonizing him is what he is about to face, what he's about to bear as he takes the sin of the world upon himself, and then he's crushed for it by the one with omnipotent power. He faced a wrath so severe in that moment that it takes a person in hell in eternity to experience it. This is what Jesus bore in that moment. I think this helps us as we think about this, because there's a difference between General Moore and Jesus. And here's the difference. Though the general suffered, he still did not suffer as much as his soldiers did. Sure, he was the first one off. But you know what? After that, guess what he did? He took command in the safe places. He's calling his people, maneuvering them. They're the ones running into the bullets first. But Jesus, on the other hand, suffered far more by tasting the wrath of God than any of us will ever experience, especially in our lifetimes. Far more. Jesus suffered far more than he'll ever call us to suffer. And he'll call us to persevere through far less than what he persevered through. And this is why we're to consider him. This is why we're to look to him. We're to actively bring him to our minds, consider what he went through, and that's what gives us endurance in the moment. And if Jesus endured the cross for you, don't you think you could endure the world for him, sickness for him, loss for him? Think back to the difficult seasons of your life you faced. How often did you consider Jesus during those hard times and what he went through? What difference would it make if you considered Jesus' suffering more often? How would that impact your gratitude? How would that impact your contentment? How would that impact your resiliency? This is what he's after here. There's, in small ways, I've looked at other people, their life's far harder than mine, and when I'm over here complaining or bitter, or, you know, maybe I'm wallowing in my own self-pity, and then I see someone over here with it way harder, keep going, I think, what am I doing over here? That just strengthens me in the moment. And that's what this is how Jesus' suffering is supposed to impact us. We consider him who endured the cross. Here's the second consideration we need to have. We need to consider the Bible's threshold of struggle. Now, I really want to be careful here. This is the hardest point for me to preach out of all these points this morning, because it's so radical. It's meant as a rebuke to these people. It's kind of a gut punch. And honestly, for some of you, I know what you've gone through. I know what you're going through. And there's part of it that's just like, I just want to say, cover your ears, right? Because I'm not trying to hound this on you. But there's some of us who do just really need to hear this and let this settle in. So let me preface before I read this verse by saying this. This is targeted towards people who are ready to give up and walk away from Jesus because of how hard their life is. This is not a verse I take to a funeral. It's meant to rescue those ready to quit, not to be insensitive towards those who are hurt or grieving. Okay, I just want to preface by saying that. With what Jesus went through in mind, as well as we could even say all the saints in Hebrews 11, look at verse 4. Look at what he says. He says this. You have not resisted to bloodshed, striving against sin. Here's what he's saying. When it talks about bloodshed there, it's talking about death. And he's saying this. You haven't even died yet. He's looking at these people. He says, come on, guys. In your fight against sin, in your fight to keep going, you haven't even died yet, and you're thinking about quitting. I mean, that's why that just feels so harsh. It's so harsh. But I think some of us just need to hear it. It just shocks us out of our state. And we can ask the question, well, hold on a second. Are we just going to pretend that dying is not a big deal? That sounds like a big deal to me. What this is calling for is extreme. He's saying, don't lose heart yet because you haven't even died. Is that the motto of life that we're to live by? And it's not as though he's saying this to them because they're you know, struggling through such minor stuff and they're ready to give up. No, these people, as we read, they've been plundered. They've been robbed. They've been imprisoned. They've gone through tons of severe things that we're not even close to in some regards. And yet he says, that's okay. You haven't died yet. Keep going. How is that the motto? Well, we need to remember that Jesus says this. He says, count the cost before following me. People would come to him, say, I'll follow you, and Jesus would talk them out of it. I don't have a place to lay my head. Oh, you're coming to me? There's a bunch of crowds? Take up your cross if you want to follow me. Die to yourself. Whoever would lose his life for my sake will gain it. Weird statements like this. Not a popular evangelistic method, right? That's not what you hear at the revivals, but that's what Jesus said. And for us, sometimes, we can forget that that's what we signed up for. The Christian life is not a bunch of rainbows, not a bunch of lollipops. It's not light and fluffy. The Bible says all who desire to live a godly life will be persecuted. It says that in the same way it was granted to you to believe in Jesus, it was also granted to you to suffer for his sake. And many of the apostles and Jesus' earliest disciples, we know what happened to them. We know how their lives ended. And if we don't understand that on the front end, man, we're going to be, our worldview is going to be blown to smithereens once we get into it. Jesus is trying to help these people understand what they're signing up for if they follow him. And sometimes I wonder if we understand that. If we understand that. And if we don't, then when our faith starts to cost us something, our reputation, family relationships, parents, siblings, children, friends, financial opportunities, we throw our hands up confused, and Jesus says, well, hold on a second, didn't I warn you what would happen? Isn't this what we signed up for? And so the point that this passage is helping us understand is that what Jesus calls to us to is to suffer radically and to keep going. Parents, you'll especially understand this. I don't mean for this to be like, again, I'm not trying to be little suffering. I'm just trying to help convey what he's saying to these people. Have you ever seen a child, maybe you work in children's ministry, or you even if maybe you have younger siblings that you even help babysit. You see a child get upset, maybe it's snack time. They get the goldfish instead of the red goldfish. And then what do? Well, they start crying. And then how do we respond to that? We're like, oh, it's okay. We're comforting them, but we're also kind of chuckling. Like, just wait, kid. Life gets a lot harder than this. Just hold on, right? It's a little bit cute. And I think sometimes if we're not careful, we can be like that child. We can make a much bigger deal out of our problems than what they really are, right? In the same way, right? I brought up Viktor Frankl at the beginning. In the same way that he said a person's attitude toward their suffering can lighten it, even though the pain remains the same, well, I think the reverse can happen too. Our attitude can make the suffering heavier, even though the pain remains the same. And when we make our problems heavier than they are, then we will give up far before the point that anyone should ever think about giving up. And why is that? Well, because it just no longer seems doable. If we convince ourselves that a level 2 suffering is actually a level 10 suffering, then we will give ourselves all kinds of excuses to give in. And these people here, I would say, I don't know, they're at like level 8 or 9, and he's like, that's still not level 10. And I wonder if perhaps the Christians throughout history who have lost their homes, relationships, all of these things, or even modern day Christians in places like North Korea or Nigeria wouldn't look at us and what we're despairing over like that adult looks at that child. Because our greatest pressures are their normal everyday pressures. Is our threshold too low? Are our buttons too easily pushed? Our irritable button, our anxiety button, our despair button. When temptation comes, are we ready to throw in the towel after a minute, 2 minutes, 5 minutes, 10 minutes? We see a couple, we see a feint, we see a couple of jabs, and we're just ready to throw it in. Or do we look around and we say, well, am I bleeding yet? No? Okay, well, I can't throw in the towel then. I must keep going. Like, this is just the resilient mindset that he's calling these people to have. Are our buttons too easily pushed? Here's the third consideration. Let's keep moving. We want to have endurance. Consider that suffering can be proof of God's love for you. Man, that sounds weird. I better explain that. Look at verse 5. He continues. And have you forgotten the exhortation which speaks to you as sons? My son, do not despise the chastening of the Lord, nor be discouraged when you are rebuked by him. Well, here's the reason, right? Why not be discouraged? Here's the reason why, verse 6. For whom the Lord loves, he chastens, and scourges every son whom he receives. Verse 7. If you endure chastening, God deals with you as sons. For what son is there whom a father does not chasten? Here's what he's saying. He's saying this. God's sovereign over circumstances, and he disciplines his people because he's their father. And why does he discipline them? He disciplines us because he loves us. So he's saying to them, have you forgotten that maybe all of these hardships are coming from the sovereign and loving hand of your father because he has a heart of love for you? Have you forgotten that? Have you not thought about that? And it's necessary for us to hear this because when we face pressures, we're tempted to think, well, God's not for me. Where are you, God? Do you not love me? Why is this happening to me? I thought I was your child. I look around, I see all these people who give no thought to you day in and day out, and their lives are fine and dandy. No troubles, but I'm your child. And this is happening? Where are you? Or when we sin, and then hardship comes, we're tempted to think, well, maybe God just doesn't love me anymore. I've broken promise after promise. He's fed up with me. Sure, he's gracious, but maybe not towards me. Or sometimes we're just quick to assume that we did something wrong when hardship comes. So we retrace our steps, and we think, man, I must have blown it somewhere. I really deserve this. But that's not always the case. We'll talk about that in just a moment. But the people that start to teeter on the line of forsaking Christ, and then those that do, their decision began with thoughts like this. They say, see, this is proof that you don't love me. We take all of our sufferings, all of the tragedies, all of these things, and we put them in the pile of evidence over here. We pile it up and say, this is the evidence pile for you not loving me. And the author of Hebrews is saying, well, hold on a second. Because God disciplines his children and treats us as sons, instead of using all of this as evidence that he doesn't love you, maybe you need to start using it as evidence that he does love you. Because a father disciplines his own child. He doesn't discipline other people's child, but he does discipline his own children. Look at verse 8. He says, but if you are without chastening, of which all have become partakers, then you are illegitimate and not sons. And so he's saying this. You shouldn't call into question God's love when you suffer. If anything, you should call into question God's love for you if you never experience discipline. Because if you don't, you're not his son. He's not caring to discipline you. You're not his child. Because if God disciplines his sons and you don't get disciplined, then what does that communicate about your sonship? Proverbs 13:24 says this, whoever spares the rod hates his son, but he who loves him is diligent to discipline him. If God didn't discipline us, what would that say about his love for us? See how he's completely changing their perspective on this. This isn't evidence that he is against me. It's evidence that he's for me. Now, I just want to be careful here. Because some of you, your lives have been relatively easy. I don't want to scare you into thinking that, well, my life's not hard, God must not love me. I don't want to do that. But what I am saying is, over the stretch of your life, if you see no discipline, you should think, am I a son? Am I a daughter? That's when the concern should come. And I also want you to be careful that you thinking every time you're disciplined, it is because you've sinned. And sure, I know we sin every day, but that's not always true. There's two kinds of discipline. There's reactive discipline. This is what we think about with a parent child, right? They do something wrong. Maybe the child gets a spanking. So I am correcting and disciplining them because of what they've done. But then there's also proactive discipline, where God disciplines not because we just messed up, but he's disciplining us anticipating that we're going to face something in the future that we need to be prepared for. Think of it like boot camp for soldiers. They go to boot camp, why? Not because they're horrible, because they're going to prepare them, discipline their bodies for what's ahead of them. Or if you've ever been an athlete, you show up the first week of practice, what do? They run you into the ground. Why? Well, it's not because you showed up and looked at your coach funny, right? That's not why. It's because he's preparing, he knows what the game will require of you, and so he's getting you prepared for that moment. This is how God can also discipline us. It's the same with him. There are times where he disciplines us because we've sinned, and there are times when he disciplines us not because we have sinned, but to prepare us for what lies ahead. But either way, it comes from a heart of love. And so we put it in the pile of evidence that God really does care to treat me as his own. Here's the fourth consideration to help us endure. We need to consider God's goal for our struggle. Look at verse 9. Furthermore, we have had human fathers who corrected us, and we paid them respect. Shall we not much more readily be in subjection to the Father of spirits and live? If you have good parents, they will discipline you. And he's saying, are we to respect our parents for that, but not respect God when he does that? That's what he's saying here. We should be actually more willing to sit under God's discipline. Here's why. Look at verse 10. For they, our parents, indeed for a few days chastened us, as seemed best to them. But he, God, for our profit, that we may be partakers of his holiness. Now here's the difference he's drawing on. There is a difference between how your parents disciplined you or how you are currently disciplining your children and God's discipline. Because as parents, guess what? Do we always discipline rightly? No, we don't. Sometimes we discipline too extreme, too little, at the wrong time. Sometimes we do it in the, you know, just because we were led to believe something else. Sometimes we don't even do it for our child's good. We're just upset. We're not even thinking about correction. We're just thinking, you just interfered. You've inconvenienced me, and you'll learn not to do that. But when it comes to God and how he disciplines, his discipline is different in that he always disciplines perfectly. And the goal of his discipline is always for our profit, that we might be partakers of holiness. His discipline always has the goal for us to be like Christ. And he knows what we need. He knows just the right amount, just the right dosage, just the right amount of pressure to best set us up for holiness. Look at verse 11. Here's, again, what it accomplishes. It says, now no chastening seems to be joyful for the present, but painful. Nevertheless, afterward, it yields the peaceable fruit of righteousness to those who have been trained by it. Is he saying that because God uses it for your holiness that it's not painful? Did you say it's not going to hurt? No, of course it's going to hurt. Of course it's still going to be painful in the present. But afterward, it yields great reward. Now, if you might be thinking, okay, I understand that. I'm following. But my question is it worth the pain? Because if you walk up here and, I don't know, you just shoot me in the hand and then give me a dollar, say, here's your reward, I'm going to tell you that wasn't worth it, right? You need to pay me far more than that. And for these people, right, they're thrown in prison, having their possessions plundered, all of these things, right? I'm sure it's for discipline's sake, but the question I'd be asking is it worth it? Is the pain worth the reward? Even today, Christians get cancer. Christians lose their loved ones unexpectedly. They lose their parents, kids, siblings. Is that measure of pain, is there something that's worth that? Is holiness worth it? That's really the question. Is holiness worth it? And to answer that question, let's just first consider the alternative. If God never disciplined us. I'm sure you all have the picture of the spoiled child in your mind. At the grocery store, in the aisle, wants candy, parent says no, child immediately drops to the floor, screams, makes a giant scene, and then what does the parent do? Well, the parent caves and tries to hush the child, and we're all thinking, that's a miserable life. That's horrible. And then what does that child grow up into? Well, to be just a monster, self-centered, entitled. And this is what happened with Israel in the Old Testament. When they reached a peak of prosperity, that's when they turned away from God. It's almost as if their hardships bound them closer to the Lord than their prosperity did. And I think if God did not discipline us, we would face the same fate of growing up and being spoiled and drifting further from God than if we were walking through discipline. There's sometimes I had one person, not from this church, I was counseling. Their life was horrible. It was bad. But then they're just leaning on the Lord, leaning on the Lord, leaning on the Lord. Then the pressure's removed. Their life starts to go great, and they just didn't care anymore. And I'm thinking in the back of my mind as I'm sitting across the desk, I liked you a lot more when your life was hard. What is going on here? You don't care anymore about the Lord or his things. That's the alternative. And also, I'd just like to remind you, the reason holiness is worth it also is because God designed us to live for him. That's why we're made, to find our full satisfaction in worshiping him. And the holier he makes us, the more true joy, true settledness, true satisfaction we begin to experience. Why? Because that's what we were designed to do. And we will find most fulfillment when we live according to our design. Some of you know Christians who have walked through horrible circumstances, and then they just still seem like the most joyful people ever. They can still smile. There's something about that we envy. But how did they get there? Because they were trained by discipline. And some of the most godly people we know are those that have walked through some of the worst that this life has to offer and yet cling to God. Holiness is worth it. And we don't think that way. We put comfort before holiness. And God says, your holiness is so important, I'll take your comfort away if it means to make you more holy. We say, God, I'll be more holy if you give me this. Just imagine how faithful I'd be. God says, you're holier without it sometimes, right, when he chooses to take it. And we just have to submit ourselves to his discipline and to trust his good intentions. And so again, just as we bring this all into focus together, right, when all of these things, when we consider what Jesus endured, when we consider the Bible's threshold for suffering that it calls us to, when we consider that suffering is proof of God's love for us, when we consider God's goal in our struggle, we can catch a second wind in our run, and we can do what verse 12 calls us to do. Look at it. Therefore, because of all these things, Therefore, strengthen the hands which hang down and the feeble knees, right? We're just so tired, right? He's saying strengthen these things. Make straight paths for your feet so that what is lame may not be dislocated, but rather healed. So there's this healing, this strength that comes from calling these things to mind. And it's like coming down the last stretch when the crowd in the bleachers is cheering and you're coming down. And the adrenaline kicks in and you just go. Does your heart rate lower? No. Do your lungs stop breathing as heavy? No. Do your legs feel less painful? No. But you just go. You just keep running. That's the same kind of impact that Hebrews 12 has on us when we call these things to mind. When we reframe our perspective. Does it make it easier? Less painful? No. But does it make it bearable? Yes, it does. I ask you to bow your heads. Let's just reflect on the sermon, the truth of Hebrews 12. Ask yourself, in your suffering, does your perspective match what Hebrews 12 calls us to? And if there's any shortcomings that you have been convicted of, take those to the Lord. Ask Him to help you to be mindful of these things so that you might be more resilient. Let's pray and let's reflect.